This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. And today, I'm really delighted to have with me none other than Billy Bragg, the British punk folk singer and political activist. Billy Bragg, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Good to be here.
Well, you're right here in Madison, Wisconsin, where the Progressive is located. And I understand you're here to give a show tonight, which I'm going to with my wife and my son. Why'd you come to Madison?
Well, I wanted to come to Madison ever since Governor Walker tried to start bringing in his austerity measures in January of 2011. I was due to do some shows in March 2011 with Mavis Staples, and I was starting to think to myself, you know, it might be worth going over a few days early to go and take part. And then, unfortunately, my mum took ill and passed away in January, passed away in March 2011, so I wasn't able to come. So when I did get to finally come and do some shows somewhere vaguely near Madison, and vaguely near Madison on this tour is Winnipeg. I said to my my agent in New York, you know, is that old Barrymore Theatre still standing? Isn't it about time we went to Madison? So, and it's very fitting to be in Madison today, because it's the week of the 100th anniversary of Woody Guthrie's birth, and I went along this afternoon to the sing-along they have at the Capitol Steps.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
It is wonderful, because you know what? Woody Guthrie never played anywhere like the Barrymore Theatre. He never, you know, did the sort of things I did. He never was selling CDs or T-shirts. He was doing exactly what I did today, standing with workers on picket lines, on protest lines, singing the old songs and you know, sort of rallying the old-time religion. And so it was great to be down there today, because I think that's, on this tour anyway, it's probably the closest I've done to do what Woody did.
What did you make of the Wisconsin uprising when you were looking at it from afar?
Well, it probably would have been good to start in June, I think, probably. When I saw the pictures of Tom Morello trying to play There Is Power in the Union with gloves on, I thought, well, he's not going to be shredding. And there's a great... Someone handed me a copy of the record they made of the communal singing of... this is called This Is What Democracy Looks Like.
Right.
It looks like a lot of people singing in a snowstorm, which is news to me. So I think it was incredibly empowering. I think the physical presence of the protesters inside the state capitol building was a clear expression of people's anger at the austerity agenda. And, of course, you know, what's happening here in Wisconsin is just part of a much wider movement. When you think about the students in Montreal protesting against the tuition fee hike, our own students in the UK, the people in Spain and Greece, all of them fighting against the kind of right-wing austerity measures that Governor Walker is seeking to introduce here in Wisconsin. It's great to see it in America, though, because America kind of gets a bit overlooked in this at home. You know, we've all... Well, not me personally, but a lot of my good comrades kind of gave up on the United States of America and figured that you don't do that kind of thing anymore. So it was...
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that, Billy Bragg, because when right before it started here, we saw the big protests in Greece, and we saw the protests in France, and we saw the indignant ones in Spain, and the students in Chile, and the people marching in London. And I said to myself, you know, when's it going to happen here? Is it ever going to happen here? And then it happened here, right here, right outside our door. And that was just so remarkable to see. And then people would come from New York City, left-wing intellectuals who'd never seen anything like it.
Yeah.
And they just were amazed at what was going on. But then ultimately we had this defeat. And there is a sense both of defiance but also dejection here.
Yeah.
And what do you tell people who get dejected, who are dejected about this?
Well, you know, in those adverts they have on the telly where they read all those things out very quick at the end. Yeah, one of them is democracy doesn't always turn out the way you want it to do. That's the problem with it, you know. The people's will doesn't always coincide with your will. You can't always get people to focus on exactly the same issue that you want to focus when you call the people out. It's just a single tool, really, isn't it, in the ways of confronting the Republican Party, the two-party machine, the whole situation you have in the United States of America that seems to have been, through the use of money and power, to squeeze out any radicalism. But I think what it did here in Wisconsin, it didn't only send a beacon out to people around the United States of America and the rest of the world that there is a radical spirit in the US. It also sort of highlighted the incipient problems you have in the US with the funding of politics and the way that the whole debate about politics has become polarized. In my country, every election has spending limits. Candidates can go to prison if they spend more money than they should on an election. We have a complete ban on political advertising of any kind. Every political party during an election is given a 3-minute broadcast on all channels simultaneous. The major parties do it 3 times during the election, the smaller parties 1 time. And of course, on the BBC and other broadcasters, there has to be balanced reporting. You don't seem to have done any of those things. If you started to, people started to understand that, as you've seen what's happened here in Wisconsin, they may begin to look at this issue. The other thing that you desperately need, I think, is some form of proportional representation in your voting. I can't understand. I've been coming to America for over 25 years. I've never met an activist fighting for PR in the United States of America, proportional representation where everyone's vote counts. I've never understood why the movement isn't bigger here.
Yeah, there are some people in the left-wing movement here who talk about that and talk about instant runoff voting, but you know, it's the two-party system is so locked in here that seems like an uphill battle. And the other battle that you raise is this battle about money and politics. I mean, we've got to amend the U.S. Constitution so that corporations can't just buy candidates. I mean, that's what happened with Scott Walker, where he outraised the Democratic opponent 7-1, 10-1, just ridiculous. Tens of millions of dollars. He was getting $500,000 checks from every right-wing
Well, you've got to remember that corporations are people. They're just phenomenally rich right-wing people.
Well, we got to solve that problem once and for all. We're not going to have democracy here. That's,
yeah, I mean, it's not just your problem. I mean, we have that problem in our country. Perhaps it's more subtle in our country. You know, I'm sure your listeners are aware of the way the banks have totally skewed the playing field for our economy. It's a different kind of financial corruption, but it's happening all the same. And my hunch is that the irresistible force of the financial markets is going to hit the immovable object of the people of Europe anyway sometime
soon. And are the people
of
Europe going to win?
Well, I think we're going to find that the actual, you know, despite what our political leaders have told us, the free market, the financial markets are not actually an irresistible force. They're quite malleable, actually. They're scaredy cats. They run away from, you know, any chance they might lose their money. And they're starting to be found out. I mean, in May, Barclays Bank announced that it had made £2.8 billion worth of profits to its shareholders, the people who own the company. And it gave 25% of that money, £720 million, as a dividend to the shareholders. The other 75% of that profit, £2.1 billion, they paid it to themselves as bonuses. Now, if capitalism is even eating its own children, you know, the people who believe in it, the people who invest, the people who own the company, you know, the denouement, I think, is coming soon for
I know,
those,
but we've been
people.
Waiting for the denouement of capitalism for 200 years here.
Well, I think it's a process, isn't it? It's a process. You know, I think what we're finding is that the people are starting to realize that the individual cannot solve all of society's problems. I mean, take the environment, for instance. It's got to be a collective solution. And in my country, we believe that the individual is the most important facet in society, but unless each individual is the recipient of free healthcare, free education, decent affordable housing, proper pensions, only the rich and the powerful will get to express their individuality, and the rest of us will simply be exploited by them. And you know, my parents' generation founded a free health system, free education, all those things, and you know, we still have to defend them every year. I mean, it's not a given in my country. We're still fighting. We're not in kind of like, you know, social medicine paradise. I mean, look at our teeth. You know, the system has flaws, and we do have to fight for it, but ultimately it will come to the United States of America, I think.
But we have a cruder capitalism here still that is in control, and also, I mean, financial capital is in control in Europe, too. I mean, they run the show.
Yeah, but American capital is soon going to have to confront the reality of China, and I think the times when it could take terms are going to change, and that's going to open a lot of opportunities for organized labor, for, you know, looking after workers. You know, look what happened when the British Empire collapsed. Our, you know, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, we had the most powerful financial markets in the world. We had the biggest army. The denouement was not that we smashed everything in our way. The denouement was we realized actually that there are other types and other ways to become a powerful society, and we realized that through education, through healthcare, through proper housing, through looking after people, our capitalism worked better. It was more effective. So, you know, it doesn't have to be that either they win and we lose, or, you know, the whole thing goes to some crazy ass revolution.
Well, I worry about that, though. I don't know if the United States or the powers that be in the United States, or even some of the jingoistic crypto-fascists, will settle for a slight downsizing on the ladder or on the King of the Hill game that the United States likes to play all the time.
Well, I think that having sold the farm to Chinese capital already, I don't think you've got much of a hand to play, really. That's the reality of it. I mean, that's what we're finding in Europe. You know, they need us. China do need us. They need us as customers to buy their stuff. And the only way that whole thing works, you see, in the bottom line, the Chinese have got your buildings. They've got your dollars, right? Okay, so they've got you by the short and curlies, okay? But they need the American people. They don't need the Koch brothers. They need the American people to buy the stuff they're making. And in order for that to happen, the American people need proper wages. In my country at the moment, we've got a shortage of demand. Nobody's buying anything because no one's got any money and everyone's nervous. The answer to that is not to give money to the banks through quantitative easing, which is where the government credits the banks to make them feel less nervous. It's to give people money in their pockets to spend. That's the only way to make the economy rise again. And even the penny ultimately will drop in America by that, I believe.
Speaking with Billy Bragg, of course, the British punk folk singer, political activist. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. But the odd thing is the Koch brothers and a lot of people behind Mitt Romney don't understand that the people need money to buy the goods. They don't care about that. Why is that?
That's because they're married to a warped 20th century ideology. I mean, this is the weird thing, right? Anyone who's been a supporter of the Social Democratic parties in the West has had to come to the terms of the fact that about 30 years ago, they ran out of imagination. The Labour Party, the Democratic Party, the SPD in Germany, even the Socialists in France. It's been disheartening. But who would have imagined that in the wake of that, capitalism would run out of imagination? You know, they've got no answer to an economic downturn except more austerity. In my country, the central bankers are pulling the levers that normally make growth. Nothing is happening. They're going to panic. And what's their answer to it? More austerity.
Right, that's the answer. Squeeze it out of people.
But how's it going to work? Because the austerity has already made people stop buying stuff, the stuff that makes the economy grow, the stuff that generates jobs, the stuff that makes growth in the economy, you know, even if it's just a housing bubble, some sign of life. They're not doing that because they've not got any money. How do you get out of that? You don't get out of that by making people more nervous. The Conservative government's response to this nervousness is to make it easier for businesses to fire people. Duh. That's why people are nervous and not spending their money, you know. So at some point, even capitalism is going to have to understand that in order to get the growth that they need for the system to run, they've got to get it into reverse and go back and start to rewind back to where people feel confident that they're going to have money this time next year, that their house price is not going to fall out, that they're going to keep their job. The missing component, the thing that's not there, the thing that's allowed this huge gap between the rich and the poor to open up and people at the bottom to have not enough money to feel confident about, the thing that's missing is organised labour. When organised labour was smashed, then people had no rights at work, they couldn't keep themselves going, and as a consequence of that, they're constantly looking over their shoulder, they're not, you know, spending the way they would, they're worried about tomorrow. The most important aspect of an economy is confidence. Once you lose it, it's very, very hard to get that back. And the United States of America is not as isolated as it used to be economically because of globalization. And as a consequence of that, in order to have an economy that works, you need a well-educated, well-paid, healthy workforce. And that can best be achieved by a collective provision.
Well, but they're trying a more primitive approach here in the U.S. and in Europe and the Eurozone anyway. They've been trying that too.
And where did it get them?
Not
this is my
far.
Point. I mean, this is my point. They're hitting the wall. I mean, remember how the Soviet Union hit the wall? They carried on trying to do, you know, a command economy, and it didn't work. It hit the wall, and the whole thing crumbled. Well, this is where we're getting with capitalism. That all the traditional ways that the neoliberals have had of creating growth are not working. Capitalism is in crisis. It's not Karl Marx, it's Groucho Marx.
But maybe they can find enough buyers among the 1% around the world globally to make their profits and skip off to the bank.
The 1%ers don't want to live in the world that we live. They want to live in another isolated world.
You know, they do live in an isolated world.
But, you know, I think you're underestimating the power of democracy. You know, over the last few years, I've come to recognize that the enemy of all of us who want to make a better world is actually not capitalism or conservatism. It's cynicism. And it's worse than that. It's not the cynicism of Fox News that is our problem. It's the cynicism of we, the people who want to make the world a better place. And we have to fight our cynicism. We have to say to ourselves, not, yeah, but the 1%ers are going to do this, and yeah, capitalism's locked in, yeah, as a two-party, all the things you've said, basically. We have to get through that. And bollocks. Get through that bollocks.
How do you get through it?
Well, you do... You know, it seems to me, and I'm a foreigner, and I'm looking from outside, that the Tea Party, a disparate bunch of rowdies, could be characterised as people who see the glass half empty. That everyone's out to get them, everyone's greedy, everyone's, you know, taking their tax dollars. Where we on the left... We have to be the people who see the glasses half full. We have to be the optimists. We have to be the people to say that if we all club together and found a collective solution to these problems, then we would be able to have a more socially cohesive society. And it's this problem of cynicism that is at the root of racism in our society. It's at the root of the divisive aspects of capitalism. And we've got to start looking to ourselves and overcoming our own cynicism. Because I'm meeting a lot of young people on this tour at the T-shirt stall afterwards who are saying to me, you know, Bill, I can't bring myself to vote for Obama. And I find this shocking. I find this really, really shocking. There's an inch of difference, and I accept it. There's an inch of difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. But last week, we saw into that inch. And what was in there? 30 million people getting health coverage for the first time. 30 million people with pre-existing conditions who are going to be able to get health insurance. Do not tell me that the Republicans and the Democrats are the same. Like, that is cynicism. I won't accept it.
The thing that inspired me and overcame cynicism in me over the last year and a half was, one, the uprising in Wisconsin, two, the Occupy movement, three, this nonviolent revolution for gay rights, which has absolutely succeeded despite a whole mess of reactionary people in Congress and around the country. So I'm not totally cynical, but I do, you know, understand that capital's got a lot of power.
Doubt is acceptable. It's the most human of sins. Never trust anyone who has no doubts, because they're either a Trotskyite or a fundamentalist Christian.
They're both dangerous.
Or trying to sell you something on eBay. And skepticism is healthy. Cynicism, when I talk about cynicism, I mean the cynic is a person who has given in and wants you to give in to make them feel better. And you see them all the time. You see them all the time. Right. You know, I was like it. You know, when we got Blair elected, we finally got the Tories out and got Blair elected. Within a year, I saw myself on a TV program, a live TV program, jabbing some guy in the face, so angry about it. And I looked at myself and thought, you know what? While these people are in power, and this is true of Obama, we live in a world of possibilities. Not all of those possibilities will be realized. And if they're not realized, it's your fault. Because you didn't push hard enough, and you didn't lean on. You turned your back and you said, he's not my guy anymore, just because he didn't do this, 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 and this. You know. So we've got to remain engaged. The cynic is the person who ceases to engage. And that's what we've got to get, particularly our young people. We've got to get them to engage. And particularly the inspirational people in Occupy, we've got to say to them, it's not either or. We will come onto the streets with you when it's time to come onto the streets, if you will come into the ballot box with us when it's time to come into the ballot box. You know, these are exciting times, inspirational times, times to bury our cynicism.
Speaking with Billy Bragg, the British punk folk singer, political activist, I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. What do you make of Obama?
Well, the first black American president. I don't think a black man could get elected prime minister in my country. First signal from liberal America that you're still alive to the rest of the world, that it's not over, that not everybody is George W. Bush. And, you know, surprise, surprise, a Democrat who gets elected and doesn't quite come up with your wish list of things. That's what happens if you run on hope. But, you know, ultimately, if you turn your back on him in November and the other guys get back in, that's what we did with Labour. We got so fed up with Blair and the war and the bankers that we turned our back on Labour. Now the Conservatives are in. We've still got the war. We've still got the bankers in control. And now they're trying to dismantle the National Health Service. So we're in a much worse situation than we would have been if we'd have stuck with Labour. So in a two-party system like this, it's always good to be organising outside of the Democratic Party. There's a Labour movement beyond the Democratic Party. But when it's time to get your guy in the cockpit, you've got to push and shove with all your might. You know, that's not the time to be, you know, standing back and saying, oh, well, you know, didn't quite work it this way. You know, sometimes you put on a jacket that just fits right. It might not look exactly your colour. It might not exactly suit you, but it just fits cushy and right. And you have to make compromises. Politics is full of compromises.
You said a little earlier, Billy Bragg, that European socialism ran out of imagination.
I think everywhere it did.
And why is that?
Because we ended up with 15 different types of cornflake. And everyone said, well, you know, if that's... You know, that's a kind of form of equality, isn't it? Everyone can get it. They sort of started to look again at the profit motive being the main driver of the economy rather than provision being the main driver of the economy. And, you know, you've got to remember that for those of us who suffered the worst aspects of the Second World War, that my parents' generation and the rest of Europe went through a crisis that made them realise that they really are all in it together, you know. And out of that, they tried to form something that ensured that never happened again. But what happened was the people forgot. People forgot how tough it was in the 30s. People forgot what Galbraith was saying. They forgot what Orwell said. They forgot what John Maynard Keynes said, and they thought they were the masters of the universe. So, you know, it's that kind of self-delusion that's led us down this path, that anything's justifiable if it makes a profit. That's not true, actually. There are some things you can never really make a profit from. You can't make a profit from people dying. You can't make a profit from people's stupidity. You can't make a profit from homelessness. You know, you got to eradicate these things, and you got to do them collectively because it's for the good. People sleeping on your streets is bad for your neighbourhood. You know, your parents dying in poverty is a heartbreaking situation. You know, to sit and think you can't afford to go to the doctors, and you're going to have to let your condition get worse. Do you know how Canada spends 48% of what the US spends on healthcare, and they have a universal system? How do they do it? When people don't feel very well, they go to the doctor. They don't wait till they're dying to go to the doctor. So consequently, their conditions are often seen to and fixed before it costs a huge amount of money to the state to fix them. And we in the rest of the world don't understand how people in the United States of America can go out and demonstrate in favour of having no free healthcare. It's just like one of those crazy things about America that we just don't understand, like why you want to have guns and why you don't use your feet in American football.
Well, about why people are protesting against getting health care, or why one of those Tea Party persons said, keep government out of my Medicare. I mean, then you're at a level of irrationality there that
is... A glass is half full. Their glass is half empty, rather. Sorry, yeah. They always see the negative thing of anything. They never can see the broad benefit. And that's why you need to be an optimist, to be a socialist. You've got to be always thinking, yeah, you know, long term, this is going to help my kids. You know, what sort of society do we want to, you know, because ultimately, you know, we think about the ultimate battle against racism and fascism in my country. You know, I'm interested in where you come from. I'm interested in your religion and your ethnic background. But you know what? I'm really interested in how my kids are going to get on with your kids. And that supersedes everything else, quite frankly. And it's that kind of outlook that you need if you're going to be a person of the left. You have to be able to see the common good, because there is a common good. It's not just, I know they talk about that a lot in the church, but there is actually a common good. And the common good is, Winston Churchill once said, I'm paraphrasing here, he said, there's not many better things a state can do than putting milk in babies. And you can say the same with, you know, teaching kids to spell and, you know, making people better and healthy. There's not many better things a state. If a state's going to do anything, let it do that. Let's get the state out of Afghanistan and get the state out of Iraq and get it into hospitals and get it into schools.
You don't mind calling yourself a socialist? What's your definition or vision of socialism?
Socialism is nothing if it is not at heart a form of organized compassion. Anything else is doesn't justify being called socialism. That's what socialism is, organised compassion. Therefore, a free healthcare system is socialist. But you don't have to live in a socialist society to have one. I don't live in a socialist society. Mm. But we have a free healthcare system that we are all, as citizens, proud of. You know, there are people, as I speak now, in my country, you know, changing the beds of old people that have soiled themselves on my behalf. And they do a job that, you know, I think they should be paid more than someone who's moving figures around the stock market. You know, there are people out there teaching kids to read and write. You know, I sing about changing the world. Teachers actually do it every day. You know, that's their gig. And they're doing it on my behalf. I'm paying them. How more proud and patriotic could I be? That's the thing I'm most proud about in my country, that you know, we have a system that allows me to contribute to the welfare of my society and to benefit from it when I'm in need.
Speaking with Billy Bragg, musician, folk singer, activist, agitator from Britain, it's Progressive Magazine's editor, Matt Rothschild, speaking here to you on Progressive Radio. You're a singer trying to change the world, as you say, and you're celebrating Woody Guthrie's 100th anniversary birthday this year, who is also a singer changing the world. What can singers do to change the world?
Can't change the world. They can't. All they can do is inspire people to change the world. You know, when I was a 19-year-old, the first political activism I ever took part in was Rock Against Racism. And I was an opponent of a fascist political party called the National Front. I worked with a bunch of guys who, in their everyday language, they were casually racist, they were sexist, they were homophobic. And I used to witness their verbal bullying and never say anything. And then one day I went to Rock Against Racism and the Clash played. And when I got we marched through the city. When we got to the park, there were 100,000 kids just like me. And I knew that day that my generation would define themselves in opposition to discrimination of all kinds. We would be the generation of artists against apartheid, of two-tone, of Rock Against Racism. And when I went back to work on Monday morning, I knew I was not in a minority. You know, in my generation, I was in a majority. And that gave me the courage of my convictions. But it's really important that you understand it wasn't the Clash that did that. It was being in that audience and feeling that sense of power. And we applauded those same things and we sang those same songs. It was the audience that gave me the courage of my convictions. And I always believed that only the audience have the power, in fact, have the responsibility to change the world, if that's what they so desire. My job is merely to bring them together and make them feel like they're not the only person in Madison who gives a bollocks about this thing I'm talking about, you know?
You tell people to start your own revolution,
out the middleman, yeah.
Yeah, and how do they do that?
Well, they organise. Ultimately, that's the one thing that hasn't changed. You know, politics has changed. Ideology has disappeared. But a new generation in the Occupy movement here in Madison, in the student demos in Canada, are trying to articulate that compassionate ideal that I was talking about as socialism in a new way. And it doesn't matter where they are, what age they're in, it all comes down to the same thing. You've got to organize.
There you go. Collective compassion, organize, and stop bullying. I think those are fundamental things. Billy Bragg, thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.